welcome to Upzoned. Each week, we take one story from the news that touches the Strong Towns conversation and we upzone it and talk about it in depth. I'm Kia and I'm here with Strong Towns president, my friend, Chuck Marone. How are you doing today, Chuck?
Doing fantastic. We're halfway through December. I feel the pressure coming on to get this baking done before the before everybody starts arriving. We're actually hosting a little bit for Christmas, so I feel like, oh, I got to get this done. So yeah, some late nights has been
fun. Yeah. For those of you who are new, Chuck does a truly heroic amount of Christmas cookie baking. If you aren't friends with him on Facebook and you want to see his haul, I would recommend that you do that. I'm hoping to get a box this year. Oh. We've all been sort of campaigning as a staff to be included on the Christmas cookie list. But you know, well, we understand that they're a scarce and limited resource and we need to not be greedy. So I'm doing good too. I have a little bit of a cold. I wanted to apologize in advance for my advanced vocal fry. I promise I'm not just a Kardashian.
We're good
today, but
yeah.
I'm excited though to talk about our topic for today. It was actually one that was requested in part after we had decided we wanted to talk about it anyway. And it's the topic of this weird phenomenon of cities paying you to move there as a means of economic development. I started digging into this because of the recent story out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa is offering $10,000 to live there for a year, as long as you have some form of remote job. Vermont previously made the news for offering about that much in relocation expenses specifically. And there's also been a handful of other cities who have tried the same tact. And at Strong Towns, we talk a lot about how our dominant approaches to economic development are more usually rooted in building a giant stadium, doing something that really disrupts our land use pattern. Is this a friendly alternative to, you know, the pay Amazon a bunch of money to come set up shop here model? Or is this something that is just giving money to people who already need it and neglecting opportunities that there are locally? I actually don't really know where I stand on this one. So Chuck, I would love to hear your thoughts.
Good God. This is just, I have really strong thoughts on this. And I think it's just atrocious. I mean, I think it's silly beyond ridiculousness. The first time I ran across this was a small town in southern Minnesota. And like, I get like the idea that this place needs more people. It needs more population. It needs more life. It needs more activity, right? Like I get that. And if you step back and look at it, this place, you know, could benefit from having 100 more people there or 1,000 more people there. The problem is, and let me put it like this. And, you know, this is Joe Minicozzi kind of talks about cities in this way too, as being a municipal corporation. You're an incorporated municipality and you are, as a city, a corporation, just like a corporation like Target or Walmart or what have you. I mean, it's the same thing. If Walmart doesn't have enough customers, they might do sales and they might do specials and they might do enticements to get you in the door, but they still have to make money, right? They still have to pay their bills. They can't just give you $5,000 and say, come and go shopping here. And you just got to, you know, buy at least $5,000 worth of stuff, or you just got to, you know, do whatever. No city that is doing this is sitting down and doing the math on it and saying like, okay, if we spend this much to bring a family in or a person in or what have you, how long is it going to take us to get that money? No one does that. They don't do that at all. And because of that, I choke on this. I'm like, I'm sympathetic. Like, I'm sad. If you're Tulsa, you could use a lot more people. I don't think you're going to get them by paying them $10,000 a piece, you know, to pretend they like you for a year. I don't know. It's funny to me that you're on the fence on this one, because I'm not. I see this as like the ultimate crossroads between extreme desperation and, you know, this like financial illiteracy that our cities suffer from.
I mean, I think that's fair. The reason I'm on the fence is honestly just because I haven't had a chance to sit down and do the math myself. You know, I wonder how much a 1 year resident of Tulsa, Oklahoma could possibly spend in sales taxes locally, how much, you know, they're leveraging the possibility that this remote worker might buy a house there and make it their permanent home. It seems like it's a bet more than it is a guaranteed return situation, which, you know, you're swaying me right now, Chuck. I think when I think of it in those terms, it does seem kind of silly. Maybe the Vermont plan seems more attractive to me just because Vermont seems like a more attractive state to live in some ways. But, you know, it is a bit of a gamble for sure. And I wonder in some ways if like it's squeaked into the national consciousness in some ways just because it's an alternative to the way that we tend to do economic development. What's a better way to do economic development than this or putting the stadium in the ground? Let's talk about the Strongtown's alternative.
Well, let's grade on a curve here, right? Let's put, you know, out on the edge, let's go build stadiums. Let's give, you know, big corporations from out of town, let's give them huge subsidies. That would be on one end. I would put this Tulsa scheme kind of close to that. I would put just taking a big pile of cash in the middle of the town and burning it to be like a little bit better. You know, at least you'd have a bonfire for a while and people would come and show up. So I would put this as like worse than that, right?
Really?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
No, go and just go and down the street and just throw money out at people. I think you'd be better. I think you'd be way ahead doing that than what they're doing here. Before we get into the strong towns one, I want to walk through this for a second, because if let's say that you have the ideal person, right, who moves to Tulsa, Oklahoma, buys a house, and you know, decides to live there for the rest of their lives. So this is like the ideal, right? The ideal person. Right now, with the city's development pattern, they're losing money on pretty much every house that they build, right? Like every new place they build out on the edge of Tulsa, they're getting shellacked on. They're losing money. So in a sense, you could bring 1,000 new people to town. And if you're going to lose money on every one of those transactions without before the subsidy, you're going backward. Tulsa, Oklahoma, 100 people would cost them $1 million, right? If Tulsa, right, Oklahoma spent $1 million just trying to trying to help that parking lot crater of a downtown they have fill in a little bit, you know, right. Tulsa, Oklahoma has some great spots. It's got actually like two blocks here and two blocks there of what would be like great urban development, but it's all disconnected from each other. It's all like, you know, remote from each other. If they could take that $1 million they're going to spend trying to get 100 people there and actually make it, invest it in making Tulsa just a little bit more walkable, a little bit nicer, they would get way more than 100 people and they would want to be there. They wouldn't, you know, be there because you paid them to be there. So I just, the math on it, on its face, is ridiculous. And I'm not exaggerating when I say taking the pile of money and just burning it in the middle of town, you'd be money ahead than doing what they're doing now. So what would we do differently? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's, I think, the catch. A lot of times what economic development is today for cities, to me, is like the equivalent of the magic pill, right? Or the sugar high. You know, we have this epidemic of people going to the doctor and saying, you know, yeah, I don't exercise and my diet is terrible and I lead a sedentary life and I eat fats and sugars all day. But I don't feel well, or I'm not sleeping well. So give me some pill to help me, address that. And the doctor will say to you, like, no, you actually need diet and exercise. And like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Just give me the pill. To me, economic development is like the pill doctor, right? It's like the doctor is like, okay, yeah, you should be doing this. You should be doing this. You should be doing this, but you're not going to do any of those things. So let me just go out and subsidize some business to come in. Let me go out and try to find someone that we can pay to move in. Let's throw some money at this. And I actually feel like modern economic development is like the voodoo doctor. That's a disservice to voodoo doctors. I think voodoo doctors have a little bit of, sometimes their practices, are like ancient and have certain, things to them. I think that modern economic development is a sham, really. So what would we do different? I think what's the diet and exercise equivalent, right? Mm-hmm. You have to grow incrementally. You've got to make small investments. You've got to, work on making your neighborhoods better places to live. There's no shortcut to making this all work out. If you want like the best model, I think the Low Foundation, the economic gardening people, which have found a home now at the Low Foundation, I think have the best model. And it's a model that's predicated not on paying subsidies, not on, trying to throw huge amounts of money at problems. It's a model based on kind of an understanding of how business growth works. And if you want, I can go through it. It'll probably take like 3 or 4 minutes, but it's worth maybe, I think, understanding. Have you seen this economic gardening model? I know we've talked about it a lot, but I don't know how much you've actually delved into it yourself.
I've read into your articles about it and I poked around their website and I find it extremely fascinating, though I have some questions about how it applies in different scales of cities. So talk me through it, especially I think people who don't know about it should know about it because it's a really like intuitive idea when you think about it.
There's three stages of companies, stage one, two, and three. Stage one companies are your startups, brand new places. Or you can count in places that are not going to grow, like service kind of businesses, people who cut hair, people who have a coffee shop, but a non-franchise, non-growing kind of coffee shop. We serve a local market. Those are your stage one businesses. Stage two businesses are businesses that are beyond the startup phase, but not quite, major corporations or large, more than $100 million a year kind of businesses. They're the mid-sized places. And I'm going to come back to them in a second because they're the job creators. They're the ones to focus on. But the stage three businesses would be your major corporations, either publicly traded or not publicly traded, places that have been around, more than 5 years, more than 10 years, have $100 million plus in sales. These are big places. These are the ones that cities often will try to subsidize to come and move there. When we look at stage two businesses, what we see is that these are places run by entrepreneurs. They're in an early stage of development. They tend to add a lot of jobs very quickly. Those jobs tend to be high paying jobs. And the struggles that stage two businesses have are not often in finding capital, or in, the kind of things that cities would kind of subsidize into existence. Their struggles are often because, and this is a quote from Chris Gibbons, they live on the edge of chaos. When you're creating something new, there's all these kind of new things coming at you all the time. The thing that benefits stage two businesses are simple things like mentoring. a CEO has been there before. A lot of times these stage two businesses are run by people who, as entrepreneurs, understand one thing, but they don't get like, how do you run an HR department? I get like my new product or the new thing I've come up with, but I don't know how to do market research. So what the economic gardening people do is they use these tools that they've developed to do some of those back office things that entrepreneurs kind of get hung up on. So they'll hook you up with mentors to help, who've been there and done this to kind of walk you through it. They'll do that market research for you and see, here's similar products in other markets. Here's what they're charging. Here's how they're doing their advertising. Here's how they're doing their marketing campaign. Basically, they will help them get to the next stage. And in doing so, these are the types of businesses that attract huge numbers of employees and bring in lots of capital. When you look at economic gardening programs compared to traditional subsidy programs, you're talking pennies, nickels on the dollar per job compared to what traditional, like, we'll pay you to move here and create a job kind of does. Here's the awesome thing then too about stage two companies. If you grow your stage two companies, you're going to have more employees. You're going to have more people making decent wages. And guess what they need? They need to get their hair done. They need to go to a coffee shop. They need a pizza. They need stage one businesses. So all of a sudden, you don't need to subsidize stage one businesses because there's a market demand for them. You just got to make it easy for them to open up and serve that demand. Guess what? And I think the Amazon thing kind of questions this a little bit, but I'm going to pretend that Amazon has not happened in New York the way it does.
Sure.
If you have a bunch of stage two companies that are doing really well, what you wind up with is a really great dynamic workforce. And then guess who wants to move and be in your city? Stage three companies. Because stage three companies are not going primarily where subsidies are. They're going where great workers are. And if you can build your workforce through focusing on stage two companies, then all of a sudden stage three says, this is a place we want to be. So the economic gardening approach is like a Zen, economic development approach where you're pressing on the exact one spot in the like lightest way possible to get the greatest amount of return. And I find it to be absolutely brilliant.
I really like it too. And I mean, to the extent that I love the city I live in now, it's because we have engaged in some economic gardening. We definitely do the opposite of economic gardening in St. Louis. But, you know, I keep thinking about this Tulsa story from the perspective of like who the market for it is. And as someone who works remotely, I work for Strongtowns remotely. So does everyone at Strongtowns. We have staff in six different states. I would never take the Tulsa deal. I would never take the Vermont deal. Because I see that and I'm like, okay, so I would have to, you know, I like Tulsa. We visited Tulsa as part of our national summit and there were some interesting things there, but like you pay me $10,000 to give up all of my relationships and friends and a town that really I like and a neighborhood that I'm invested in. That's not enough money. That's just not enough. And it's not a good deal for Tulsa either. But when I look at St. Louis and the things that make me stay year after year after year, I'm approaching my eighth year in St. Louis. It's because there are pockets of the city where we've done a really good job of cultivating what's already there and made it a livable place. So I choose to take my paycheck, which comes from Minnesota, and spend it here in Missouri, which I know is the right thrust of this.
Right. Well, I do think too, and I don't want to be vulgar. There's a name we use when you pay someone to pretend that they like you.
Oh no.
Yeah. And there is a certain, you think about, we don't even have to go there. You Sorry. Think about like dysfunctional relationships, right?
Right.
Where it's not based on kind of mutual respect or mutual admiration. Even we don't even have to get into love, but good, healthy relationships are reciprocal, right? You give something, I give something, we meet in the middle. And, you know, what Tulsa is putting forth, what Vermont has put forth, is not a reciprocal relationship. It's not reciprocal with the people who already live there. It's not reciprocal with the people that you want to bring in. It's more of like a con job kind of relationship. And you know, I know, I think everybody understands that that's not how you build a healthy place. In the Grapes of Wrath, there's this big part of the book where they are they're desperate, they're leaving Oklahoma, they've got to go someplace else, and they're given this like bill of sale, this pamphlet that says, you know, move to California, there's jobs, there's opportunity, there's all this, and they pack up and they move to California. And of course they get there and it winds up that the whole thing is a con job, right? Just to get you there, yep. To drive down labor costs and what have you. I feel like whenever you're getting into these gimmicks, these con job kind of things, it feels to me like, you know, you're trying to run a city like you're P.T. Barnum or something. I mean, just be honest with people. Like, look, Oklahoma is a great state. It's got a lot of good things going on. I was in like the little town of McAllister. This is not a great place. This is not a place that, you know, is going to wind up in some travel log somewhere. But my gosh, they're doing great things with what they've got. And it's getting better. And you can see how if they keep doing this year after year after year, it's going to be fantastic. There were some really great neighborhoods in Tulsa and some really bright people there that are saying, hey, we know we're broke. We know we don't have a lot of money. We know we can't just, you know, do whatever. We've got to roll up our sleeves and make it work. Double down on those people.
Yeah.
You know, you've got great assets. To me, I feel like this con game thing, it almost depresses me, you know? It really does, because it's saying on one hand, we suck and we know it. You know, we're a crappy place and we know it. And we also have no idea how to fix it. And so we're just going to throw money and pretend that, you know, it doesn't exist this way. And I just, it makes me depressed, because Tulsa is not a bad place, you know?
Right. You should
have to pay someone $10,000 to move there. You know, you should be able to keep your own people who want to, you know, they want to stay there. Just make it a better, you know, just give them some hope that it's going to be a better place tomorrow than it is today, and they will stay, and more people will move there. You know,
that's really inspiring. And I hope Oklahoma is listening. I know we've got a lot of folks in Oklahoma since we did the summit there. And, you know, I think that having that confidence and to view government spending as a mechanism for, you know, building on your existing strengths is a really inspiring message, because you do have them. I know the people in Oklahoma who I met know their assets. They know where they are. They could point you to them. And if there are any local Oklahoma members of government listening, we will be happy to connect you with them. Just send me an email, team@strongtowns.org. So let's finish up by going to the down zone here. I would love to hear a little bit about what you're reading, or probably watching right now, Chuck, because I know you like to watch movies while you make Christmas cookies and listen to podcasts and all that good stuff. So tell me what's been kind of on your pop culture hit list.
It's kind of funny, because this time of year, I do watch some movies while I'm baking. I also listen to fiction. This is the only time of year I really, besides when we go on vacation, that I dig into fiction. I've gone through three books in the last like 2 weeks, audiobooks, listening to them. There's a John Sanford book. I don't know if you know John Sanford, but he's a Minnesota author, writes about basically like police detective stories. And he's got a new one that came out in September called Holy Ghost. And I went through that. I also went through the latest Jack Reacher novel, which I just finished up yesterday, which is really cool. And now I'm reading the new Vince Flynn. Vince Flynn, of course, passed away. Another Minnesota author passed away not too long ago. But they're continuing to release books kind of inspired by his characters. And they're just fun. And I'm like 3/4 of the way through that one and need to get back to baking so I can finish it, because it's really good.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, I'm sort of in early New Year's resolution mode. My perennial New Year's resolution is always to write more and be more productive in my writing. So I picked up a book called Daily Rituals, which is just, it's really interesting. It's this really... it's a book of just short quips about how various writers, composers, painters, creative people, you name it, did their work. Like, down to they woke up at 6 in the morning. This is what they ate for breakfast. This is what they did before they wrote, you know. And some of them are really, really funny. Like, it talks about how Gertrude Stein would just like make her partner drive her around and look at cows for hours before she would write half an hour and she was done. And some of them are really useful. So I'm just enjoying digging into the process of how people sit down and do cool stuff. And, you know, it's a short, breezy read, and I'm enjoying it a lot. So hopefully it'll inspire some interesting new work habits in the coming year.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think this is going to be our last upzone of the year.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, just because I'm interested. When you get writer's block, what tactics do you use to get through that?
Write anyway, like literally just keep writing, like write the dumbest, stupidest stuff that you can think of. Sometimes that means toggling to another project for a little bit. Sometimes that just means forcing myself to keep working on a current project, even though I have no good ideas and I know it's bad, but just getting words down on the page. I just don't believe in honoring writer's block at all, because I have it all the time, like every day I have it. Plowing is the biggest thing. Sometimes if I'm like in between projects and I'm looking for ideas, I've got like some exercises that I've given to my students when I've taught fiction about, you know, find a historical moment that doesn't seem to tell the whole story. And I'll go on a hunt for that. I call it like scavenger hunting. I've got a whole list of little prompts like that for myself that are tried and true and have worked for me many times. But mostly it's just like sitting through and putting my head down and working as hard as I can. I'm very Midwestern in my habits. So yeah.
That's so interesting to me. I find myself just staring at a blank page. Like I couldn't plow through it if I wanted to. It's like my brain is stuck.
Yeah.
And I will go for long walks. I mean, I'll walk for an hour and just listen to something. And it's almost like I'll listen to a podcast or something that is interesting, but like, I don't need to know the information. And it's almost like I'm tricking my brain into releasing that whatever blood clot it is that's keeping the thought from coming out.
Yeah.
And if I can distract my brain, then it's like the other part of it flows out, you know? So I don't know, long walks for me.
Yeah. I do love a long walk when I can find the time for it, for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this first season, I guess, of Upzone. We're ending the year strong. If you have any suggestions for topics you'd like us to tackle in the future, hit us with those after the first of the year. We always like a good, timely story that touches the Strongtowns conversation and merits some more conversation among our staff. You can email us at team@strongtowns.org. You can also help the show reach more people by giving us a 5-star review, ideally, on iTunes, or you can join the Strongtowns movement, which is your way of directly investing in what we do. You can do that at strongtowns.org/membership at any amount that is accessible to you, and it is fully tax deductible because we're a nonprofit. Thank you so much for all that you've done this year to make your town stronger, and thank you so much for listening in. Happy holidays, everybody.